Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 46. We're just talking about Cage.
Now, it is very, very rare for us to actually time an episode and a pop culture event in such a way that we can actually use the Shag Matthews TM search engine optimization. But this time...
I mean, we've tried. We've thought about it. It's been on our list of things to do.
And then time marches on without us.
We may have pulled it off this time.
So hopefully, you are listening to this within about 3 or 4 days of the Luke Cage show coming to Netflix.
So after 3 years, maybe, just maybe, we got the timing right on something. But the bandwagon jumping is going to have to wait for a few minutes. Because first, we've got feedback.
First, one new iTunes review that gave us 5 more stars.
Yay!
Angus McCracken, where I really hope that's your real name, titled his feedback, "Great Podcasting Fun. Great podcasts and hosts that make you feel you're part of their comic book family."
Aww. That's nice. Then, surprise, surprise, more talk about comic book numbering and organizing.
This is just the can of worms that keeps on giving.
Now, we had a few people who were either a little late listening to the episode or who had feedback on our feedback section where listeners related their thoughts, opinions, and methods of comic book numbering and organizing.
As a matter of fact, David Foster specifically commented on Mark Sweeney's description of how his employer organizes comics. "I just finished listening to this episode. You know, I used to respect the Rhode Island School of Design until I heard about their idiotic filing system."
But evidently a good hiring system.
Yes.
Clinton Robeson of the Coffee and Comics blog wrote in with his thoughts. "Alan and Emily, a lovely discussion on a topic that both intrigues and annoys many comics readers. At one point, Emily brought up something I was hoping would be discussed. How one cites a comic."
Let's just say, dumbly.
"Well, it just so happens that Clinton has a small bit of personal experience with this. My master's thesis was heavily focused on comics, which, first of all, makes him even cooler than I thought he was even before, but now that I know that."
Yes.
"Hopefully his English and grammar was better in his master's thesis than mine just was then. Granted, I can't speak for all disciplines, but the MLA guidebook has a specific guideline for how to cite a graphic novel, and by extension a trade paperback, heading off that argument even before it starts. However, at the time of my thesis in 2009, there was no listed format for single issues, hence Emily's point. I was told by my mentor profs to use my own experience and expertise to create a format, and I cited single issues as a combination of the graphic novel format and a magazine. It really goes back to the point that both of you made about magazines being listed as month, year. However, since comics do include those numbers and volume numbers as well, all relevant information has to be included. As he pointed out, the goal of citations or a works cited page is to make it impossible for a reader to mistake what you're attempting to cite. So putting in as much information as possible is the way to go. Does that ring true to you?"
Yep, absolutely. And, necessitates a lot of typing.
See, that's what I was thinking, because comic books can have a large number of creators. I didn't know if the citation would involve just the part of the issue that the focus is on. Like, if you're talking about the writing, do you citation just include just the writer? I mean, do you always have to include the letterer?
Yeah.
And the assistant editor, and I mean, I guess in the name of avoiding confusion, I get if the name is there, you include it.
I think I would probably go with cover information. However, the cover is listed, because sometimes there are like 6 writers on an 80-page giant.
True.
That you would probably do a first two writers et al., and then comma,
right.
Primary
you're
artist.
You're et al.
Always et al. Is your friend. But I would probably go with whoever's listed on the cover as far as creators.
Now, that's changed over the years, so they've added more and more people. And even when you're going back to Golden Age or even Silver Age, there's some uncertainty as to who the creators are. They're not listed specifically in the book, but Grand Comic Books Database and Mike's Amazing World and places like that have gone and either through interviews or just
comparisons
and hunches have assigned writers and artists and so on. So the further back you go, the more difficult it becomes. Though the more recent it goes, the more number of names you have to cite.
Yeah, and I mean, at least for an old issue, if you say Action Comics number whatever, 1942.
Right.
I mean, there's only going to be
fair,
one.
That's fair. Then I guess there could be some internecine warfare between comic book scholars. Like if you're citing the FF, does Lee's name go first or Kirby's?
Bum, bum, bum.
Sorry if that description ran long. Excellent episode, Clinton.
Matt Ev wrote in response to the previous episode, I was going to tell you how I organized my comics, but I was pretty sure you'd think me insane. Apparently my fears were well-founded. I look forward to hearing how everyone else is doing it all wrong.
Exactly, and that's the point that we wanted to make.
Exactly. Everyone's wrong.
And crazy.
Yes. So much therapy.
Our work here is complete.
So much therapy
do
we all require.
Is done. Trevor Williams wrote in about the potential unintended consequences of hearing dozens of geeks describe their organizing processes. I'm actually scared to listen to the organizing section of this podcast. My unique system is perfect, in my humble opinion, but I acknowledge that I'm easily impressed with new ideas, and the thought of completely reorganizing 30-plus long boxes is terrifying.
I mean, I'm not saying that our listeners are not smart and organizationally savvy and wouldn't have great ideas.
But that's part of the problem.
But nothing.
Great ideas.
No idea is 30 long boxes good.
Especially not the one used by the Rhode Island School of Design. Can I get a witness? Hello!
Woo-woo. We also heard from Tom Penerese, who at first regretted that he was too slow to reply, as we had already done the feedback episode, but he said that his library's organizational system would drive me crazy.
So I badgered him into sending this piece of feedback.
Oh.
Because that's what dads do.
Awesome. Hello, Middletons. I'm late to emailing you guys about your comics organization talk. Although it shouldn't be a surprise. I think I have nearly 50 emails to various podcasts I have drafted in my head and yet never made it to the screen. I'm such a slacker.
Now we say this every few episodes, but we love getting feedback on older topics. And this one's only a couple episodes old. This one's still pretty fresh. So to any future people listening to this episode well after they were hot off the presses, feel free, always send whatever feedback you want to. Especially if it's going to drive Emily crazy.
Yay!
I mean, that's just a bonus.
I mean, to be fair, quality podcasting does that result in. Tom continues. Anyway, as I listened to you guys talk about organizing your comics and the way libraries organize their graphic novel trade paperbacks, sorry, I refuse to call anything that was originally published in a single issue a graphic novel. And yes, I know I'm being petulant about it.
Tom and Michael Bailey. They're on that side of the argument, I see.
I kept making mental notes about how I organize my own collection and how my library organizes its. My organization system isn't anything odd because I don't have as large of a collection as I used to. I have separate long boxes for DC, Marvel, and independent titles that are alphanumerically organized and have a separate set of long boxes for all of my Teen Titans comics because out of my original collection, most of which I sold off in the early 2000s, those were always the books that were never going to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a short box labeled Current Reading, which is where I put all the books that I am, well, currently reading.
See, for me, that's a pile. For you, that's a couple of shoe boxes, if I remember.
Yes, so everyone has their place. Sometimes it's the kitchen drawers. On the topic of trades and graphic novels, Tom writes, those are kept on a bookcase, and they are alphabetical by title or by character. For instance, all Batman is under B, Mouse is under M. Within the character collections, things are organized mostly by continuity. For instance, my Batman collections of trades slash OGNs start with the two editions of The Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told, then Year 1, Year 2, etc. After that are the Elseworlds or other books that are outside of the mainstream continuity.
That's not bad. I don't know if we talked about how my one and a half shelves or so of graphic novels are collected, but so many of them are Batman that they do get their own section. Now, it does happen that it was close enough to the alphabet that I just sort of scooched it a little bit, bumped Adam Strange, who would have been the start of the collection. Yes, he's under A, not S. We're not even going to go there, right?
Right.
I mean, Adam Strange goes under A. I hope we can all agree, Trevor, Jason, Tom, I don't want to hear any. I don't know how the Rhode Island School of Design would organize them, but... So, Batman comes first. Okay, technically... My collections of cartoons comes first. So, Bloom County, Calvin and Hobbes, a couple of Garfield books or Peanuts books, or those lovely Sherlock Holmes newspaper strips that Ron Sadowski sent. Those are first. Then the Tintins, because they had to go together. Then the Batmans. Everything after that is alphabetical by character. That's not... that crazy, right?
No.
Right?
Well, your concept of having collected newspaper strips separate from either OGNs or collected trades.
I don't know why.
It actually has some precedence in the way that libraries organize their books.
That is true.
As Tom points out, now my public library may give Emily a small headache. There are actually four places within the branch I go to where one can find graphic novels and trades. And having skimmed the way that he describes this, it is the standard and is the way our sister library organizes their graphic novels, comic strips, etc. And it makes me want to cry every time I see them. So, the first two are in the nonfiction section of both juvenile and adult stacks. Under our favorite Dewey Decimal number,
741.
These are arranged alphabetically by author and are usually comics reference works and collections of comic strips. For instance, the juvenile stacks have a lot of Garfield collections, and maybe some Calvin and Hobbes or Farside make it into the adult stacks.
Or sometimes the oversized Jack Kirby Reader or the Kirby Simon collections. Or certainly this is where you would find books about comic books.
Mm-hmm. Your Secret History of Wonder Woman.
Marvel the Untold Story, those sorts of books, also in there.
The next two are separate graphic novel sections, one of which is found in the Teen Room, which also has fiction and a separate section for manga. These are all arranged alphabetically by author, so if you would like to browse the graphic novels at my library, you would get a decent number of steps logged onto your Fitbit.
One of the libraries that we go to, it's actually not part of the system that your library is... an adjunct to, does it that way. And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying maybe it's a good thing because there are stairs involved.
Yes.
The nonfictions are upstairs. So you go to the adult 741. And it is sort of always interesting to see what's there.
Yeah.
Because as we said, it is the books about comics. Sometimes the biography of the creators might be there if it's not just like a one person. If it's more sort of a history of Siegel and Schuster and how they created Superman, that might be there.
If it's a Lee and Kirby book.
Exactly. It might be there. Again, comic strips tend to be there. But
except
also,
when they're not.
Yeah, but that's also where you might find your more mature graphic novel collection.
That
might be
Mouse.
Where those things like Preacher might be up in that area as well, sort of. Cordoned off in the grown-up section of the library. But then there is the juvenile 741s, plus the two graphic novel sections, the general one and the teen one. As Tom says, if you're counting your steps, make sure you've got your device with you when you go to verify
it's
that.
It's an adventure.
Like I say, what is in that adult 741 section varies widely from library to library and is interesting. I think there is a trend towards a actual graphic novel section.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those books at libraries have been pulled out of that 741.
And this is a thing that I know personally because I have talked to our librarian at my work. A lot of times libraries will have duplicate copies that they put in those sections. So we used to have 4 complete sets of Mouse and 2 complete sets of Persepolis.
Right.
2 Mouse and 1 Persepolis were each in the graphic novel section and the 741s. So if you were only finding it in one of those sections, what it actually meant was that was where people weren't going to look for it. Because the other one was getting checked out all the time. It's a thing that annoys me very deeply. I'm glad that we are sort of moving away from that.
One other thing I've noticed at some libraries is when you have, like Tom's describing, the 2 graphic novel sections, usually the quote-unquote grown-up one and the teen one, is that sometimes you will have books in the series, you know, consecutive volumes that are in the different sections. And I assume that's based on, you can speak slightly to this, I assume that's based on when it comes in, who the person is, who the specific library employee in the technical services department is, who gets the book and assigns the title and location to it.
Yes.
Flips through it, it's a comic book, it's in the juvenile section or the young adult section, or flip through it and there's some blood or there's some starred out curse words, so it goes in the other set. But the volumes come in 8 months apart, so there's no consistency, no institutional memory as to where the rest of the books in the series are.
It's a thing that our library is working on because Tom mentioned this, having a separate section for graphic novels and manga, is that what our library is sort of working towards is that the teen graphic novel section is just manga. If it is a collected comic book, if it is an original graphic novel, it goes upstairs in the graphic novels fiction section. That's just how it is. And then all of the manga pretty much goes downstairs in the teen section. However, it does mean things like One More Summer is upstairs and Death Note is downstairs.
Yeah.
The librarians in charge of that are sort of working with the technical services to be like, okay, well, these should actually be here and these should be there. Actually, we have 2 teen sections. So your Adventure Time comics and your Sisters by Raina Telgemeier, the really sort of little kids comics, they have a separate section.
Yeah, the bordering on the J/YA, the juvenile side
The YA. Juvenile side has their own thing, and then the YA stuff is all manga.
Right.
But again, there is kids manga in there, there's teen manga, and there's adult manga.
Yeah.
And it's complicated!
I think as we've learned over these last few episodes, no system is perfect. Because there are these multiple things that you're trying to balance. Trying to balance consistency, you're trying to balance what makes sense from a patron perspective. You're trying to balance what's appropriate, what you won't get complaints about.
Yes,
but
that
putting
too.
Something in the quote-unquote wrong section. The easiest way to deal with that is to age it up and put it in the next highest section.
Yes.
That's the easiest, quote-unquote, mistake to make. The safest mistake to make.
Tom continues with a little story. One quick shout-out to a friend and former colleague of mine who probably isn't listening, but since Emily works in a library, I think she'll appreciate. This friend recently moved, so she and her husband packed up all of their books. She asked me to guess the number of books they owned. I said 500, but no, 1,100. She then went on to describe their pretty intricate organization system, which was Dewey Decimal-esque. And here I was stressing that I just ran out of space for the books I have and was going to have to sell back / donate a few. Anyway, I love the show and can't wait to learn more. Never, never assume you know how many books a librarian owns. The answer is always...
too many.
Way too many.
Thank you, Tom. In terms of that last episode being our 3rd anniversary,
woohoo!
Our buddy Jason Marcinet wrote in, "Hello, Professor and Emily. Congrats on 3 years of podcasting excellence. I just started my own podcast, Heroes and Hops, about comic books and beer. Your consistency in posting great content on a regular basis is something I aspire to. Thank you for reading both pieces of my feedback. I'm glad that you enjoyed picking at my system." Well,
I mean, it's what we do.
True, it is crazy, but it makes sense to me. If I really wanted to make you cringe, I would have gone into how I file my Dead Man collection. Ooh, do you think it's by the character that Dead Man inhabits? Okay, now that would be freaking awesome, right? Or, Jason says, how I file my Spider-Man PSA comics.
You know, I'm not even going to ask why he owns those.
Much less how he files them.
I don't want to know. I don't want to. I've got to imagine it's by, like, team-up character or alphabetical.
Ooh, by sponsor.
Oh.
American Dental Association, Radio Shack, HIV AIDS Awareness. Maybe that's how he does it, by issue or by sponsor.
I'm staring off into the distance long-sufferingly. I just want everyone to be able to hear that.
Anyway, hopefully this is a shorter feedback than my last one, Jason. Now, I did tease Jason that I was a little disappointed that this email had less of a sense of being a manifesto than the one we read last episode did. He did confess that perhaps a few adult beverages may have been consumed prior to his comics organizing email.
Yes.
Makes sense.
We did get one piece of feedback on the actual comic we covered in that anniversary issue. David Foster again said, I collected this series back in the day. I started buying it because John Ostrander was writing it.
That's a good reason.
And because it promised to tie into Morrison's JLA series. I stayed with it because I grew to really like John.
That makes sense, too.
He's so lovable!
All right. Time to take a little break, shake our heads clear of all this talk about organizing our comic book collections again. And when we come back, Luke Cage and Blaxploitation.
Hello, friends. Are you looking for a brand new podcast? One that discusses comic books? Maybe you're looking for a podcast that discusses craft beer. Or maybe, just maybe, you're looking for a podcast that combines comic books and beer. Well, look no further. Heroes and Hops is here. Heroes and Hops, the show where we discuss comics, beer, and everything in between. I'm your host, Jason. I've been a fan of comic books and craft beer for some time now, and I'm looking forward to discussing and sharing my love and interest in both topics with you, the listening audience. Join me weekly as I welcome various guests as we discuss superheroes, story arcs, comic book conventions, breweries, beer styles, and food and beer pairings, just to name a few of the many topics that we can cover. We'll also, from time to time, delve into film, TV, and gaming. So sit back, relax, crack open a cold one, grab your favorite comic book, and listen to Heroes and Hops. You can search us out on iTunes at Heroes and Hops, HeroesandHops. You can also find us at heroesandhops.blogspot.com or on Facebook at, you guessed it, Heroes and Hops. You can email all your listener feedback, requests, and suggestions at heroesandhops@gmail.com. Heroes and Hops, the show where we discuss comics, beer, and everything in between. A Friends of Vortex production.
And we're back.
Now, listeners are in for a real treat today, because not only have we managed to time an episode of this podcast to coincide with a pop culture event, but in essence, you're about to hear a retooled version of an episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age that sadly never made it to the air.
Yeah, this was originally planned to be the episode 7 of UBA. I was going to focus on black DC characters and what stuff was pretty good for the time, and some other things that are plain laughable or really super cringeworthy in retrospect.
Yeah.
And because the episode had been all about the 1970s and being black, there was going to be a lot of time devoted to the blaxploitation craze.
But the good thing is that by doing it here on Shortbox Showcase, we're not limiting it to DC, like Uncovering the Bronze Age was. So we get to talk about the character who I think has made it most successfully out of the Blaxploitation era into the modern world. Maybe even better than Shaft. We're talking about Luke Cage.
And I can dig it.
Of course, as is a good Shortbox Showcase tradition, when we talk about a topic, sometimes we like to start with defining our terms.
I think it's pretty important. So, this is basically the Wikipedia definition of Blaxploitation, which is an ethnic subgenre of the exploitation film market. It emerged in the United States in the early 1970s. Blaxploitation films were originally made specifically for an urban black audience, but the genre's audience appeal broadened across racial and ethnic lines. OxfordDictionary.com also has a nice short definition, the exploitation of black people, especially with regard to stereotyped roles in movies.
Very clear and straightforward. Any definition that I looked at for exploitation or blaxploitation in particular always had the word stereotype in it. So that, to me, is the key feature, is that it is a portrayal of ethnic, in this case black, urban stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. And I liked the Wikipedia definition because it said it is a sub-genre of a sub-genre, which is exploitation cinema. And the 70s, with its kind of sleazy overtones, was the era of exploitation cinema. This is when you got your chop-socky flicks.
Mm-hmm.
You had Nazi-sploitation. You had nun-sploitation. If there was anything that you could conceptualize and then put it in an R-rated film with lots of swearing and drinking and violence, it happened in the 70s. So an exploitation movie is not just a movie exploiting its actors. It's a specific type of... Quentin Tarantino makes exploitation movies nowadays. It's that kind of sleazy...
Rawness.
Raw, kind of, like, gritty, self-indulgent, almost campy levels of violence and stereotype and over the top badassery.
In terms of comic books, there had been a few, very few successful introductions of black characters before the Blaxploitation era, but more common are the stories of failures to introduce black characters, and probably the most famous would be the attempt to introduce a black man into the Legion in 1966-67.
If you've heard the tale of the life and death of Pharaoh Ladd, he was originally intended to be a black character. Predating Rhodey as Iron Man, he was a black man in a full metal suit, so you couldn't see any of his skin. His creator, Jim Shooter, was going to have at one point a reveal where he took his helmet off, and it turned out Pharaoh Ladd, who'd been on the Legion for whatever, 9-10 issues, was also black. And it wasn't a big deal. He was an incidentally black character. And he was told by editorial that he could not do that. It was going to hurt their distribution in the South. And so, sort of in vengeance, he killed off Pharaoh Ladd instead, so that if he couldn't do what he wanted with the character, he wasn't going to let DC have the character at all.
He didn't want to be in the position, or didn't want to put Pharaoh Ladd in the position of 5 or 10 years from now, unmasking or revealing and being just another white guy.
Which he
was taking that, Shooter was taking that option totally off the table.
I'm really annoyed because if you go to Pharaoh Ladd's Wikipedia page, his picture is the Who's Who picture where he is not wearing gloves and he has white hands. I'm really frustrated by this fact.
Yeah.
And because this is essentially an episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age,
mm-hmm.
let's tie it back into episode 5 and my Wortham episode that I did. In that episode, I talked about a story called Judgment Day, which was the final EC comic. And it's also a fairly famous story
yes.
where there was an astronaut traveling to these other planets and talking to them about prejudice and how we need to be better than that. We need to inspire.
And reconciliation and harmony, etc.
Exactly. Your sort of standard Federation type right. thing mm-hmm. of like, we must all come together as a people. And it's your pretty standard sort of story. You know, it's a classic 50s pulp science fiction story.
With a twist. Because at the last page or last panel?
Because the final panel, the astronaut is back in his capsule, so he has air. He takes off his helmet, and he's black, looking up at the stars and the star field reflected in his face and saying, "We are one race." And that was not acceptable for publication.
Yeah.
It was the final EC comic, and they were like, you know what, if we can't publish this, we're out.
Yeah, yeah.
We're done with this industry.
But it seems like the blaxploitation films, the success of those films, both, I would assume, with black audiences and also with white audiences, I think sort of served as proof of concept to the comic book companies. You can either say cynically that here's a trend, we're going to jump on it.
That's what I would lean towards, the more cynical view.
I think Marvel in particular always loved jumping on whatever the newest trend was. The Silver Surfer. Or, I mean, just whatever. They would find whatever's happening in pop culture or culture and make a character from it. DC, a little more dragging of the feet, just historically. So not a surprise that the success of the films of the era spawned attempts by both DC and Marvel to introduce a new wave of African-American characters, most of whom were in the same exploitation sort of genre.
The street smart, wisecracking, kind of violent, drugs, pimps, hoes type of urban environments was pretty much the background for those stories. It is important to note, before we get going too far along, you know, well-known characters created in this era, that Black Panther
mm-hmm.
is a unique case in that he was a very successful, currently very, you know, well-known, important Marvel character who was created before this.
Yeah, we're going to argue that Luke Cage was by far the most successful of the blaxploitation characters and try to sort of may tease out exactly why that is. What is it about Cage that has enabled him to be successful 40 plus years later? And then the obvious rebuttal to that is, well, what about Black Panther? He's also incredibly popular and been a fairly well-respected, long-standing character. As Emily said, he was introduced years before in the mid-60s and really doesn't carry this blaxploitation element to him. He never did. For one thing, he's not American.
Exactly. Maybe because he's not American, and he could follow the character archetype of Namor and Doom.
Right. As the wise leader / powered being of a particular yes. geographic region, which Marvel had, as you said, done successfully.
Yeah, and so they were able to be like, well, we have a ambiguously international waters, you know, region
character. Central European character.
Yes, a Central European fellow. We'll have a guy from Africa.
But T'Challa is in that mode. He's not in the Shaft blaxploitation mode. So
yes.
to some extent, we've put him sort of in his own category.
And as a result of that, he has avoided pretty much for his entire publication history, both of the major stereotypes that black characters in comics tend to fall into, which is big black and badass, or the black best friend.
Mm, right.
That he is one of very, 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 very few independent solo black characters, and we'll get to that later in this episode. So we wanted to give a very honorable mention to T'Challa before we pretty much set him aside and talk about other types of black men in comics.
So this blaxploitation era in terms of movies is actually a fairly short time frame, 7 or 8 years in the 70s, where these types of movies were the it thing for a period of time.
Yes, the trendy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Blaxploitation is complicated because, at least at first, it was mostly black audiences, even though most of the movies and scripts and books that these things were based on were written by white authors. So that in and of itself is, we would say, problematic.
Mm-hmm.
These were not black stories by black people about themselves. It was a white perspective, assumption, mm-hmm. guess at what this experience could be like.
But that did not keep them from being popular among certain segments of black populations.
Yes. And what really showed that these were not just popular in a subcategory, but that they were popular with everyone, again, everyone in quotation marks, was that they started gaining white audience appeal and showing a comfort of a sort for white audiences seeing types of black stories. And again, this is very street, gritty, urban. There's a lot of swearing and gunplay and violence and jive talk, and it just seems really cool, but not necessarily accurate,
right.
And for a lot of people was not empowering. And some black audience members totally saw it and was like, yeah, heck yeah, this is empowering. It's a power fantasy. It's like comic books. It's escapism. But the reason that blaxploitation was pretty much a small little
blip, yeah,
was because it was eventually shut down by the Coalition Against Blaxploitation, which was a collective of NAACP and other like civil rights black leadership groups that were like, this is not acceptable.
This is not good for us.
No, we just need to put a stop to this.
So the tide sort of turned on them
in
terms of the general acceptance.
And this is reflected in Luke Cage, that there are a lot of people who have opinions, very strong opinions, about Luke Cage and what he represents and his very stereotypical type of black masculinity. And just so that this isn't just some white people talking about the black experience, so that we don't fall into 1970s Marvel stereotypes
exactly.
of... We're going to do this positively, but we have no idea what we're talking about.
We reached out to a couple of our African-American comic book podcasting friends.
And we asked for their opinions.
Asked for some opinions about blaxploitation, more specifically focusing on, to some extent, on Luke Cage.
And this episode, in large part, was an old episode from my back burner, but was sort of brought to the forefront of our minds.
Right.
Because Donovan Morgan Grant and Stella recorded an episode some months back on Batgirl to Oracle called The Minority Report. And it was talking about representation in her case for women, in his case for African-American people in comic books, and what the history of minority representation in comics has been and where we are now and where we should maybe be going. It's a great episode. It's highly recommended.
It's very long. It is also highly recommended. So some of the things that Donovan said on there we thought were very interesting. And we reached out and got some additional comments from Donovan. Also, he and Stella allowed us to play just some portions of that Minority Report episode. So we're going to drop some of that in. And also, we reached out to Derek Coward from the Comic Book Noise Network. He sent in some feedback, and in both cases, we're going to use some of their audio and then also quote and summarize a little bit of what they said about Cage in particular, and also the state of black comic book characters in general. Here's a little bit of what Donovan had to say about Cage.
You have Cage, who everybody knows and loves, except for me, because I really don't like Luke Cage. Because you and I talked about this. Like, I compared my feelings to him towards your feelings to Power Girl. You remember that?
I don't.
I know you don't really care for Power Girl because a lot of her sexuality is kind of put out at the forefront as a selling point. And Luke Cage is like, you know, his power is that he's super black, essentially. I've read his first couple of issues. He gets his powers in prison. And he's a very kind of like blaxploitation-y kind of character. Well, the thing is, though, is that like my father loves Luke Cage. Like, he read Marvel Comics when he was a teenager. He absolutely loved Luke Cage and tried to get me into him. But I just couldn't relate to him. He's nothing like me. He doesn't really reflect any of what I care about or anything that I'm interested in. But he's kind of, you know, maintained existence for a long time now. He's going to have a show coming out. I'm not saying that he's necessarily a bad character, but he's kind of like, for a long time, seen as the template on how to do a black character. And at least in the beginning, he's awfully one-dimensional. Every time I saw him for a long time, I would just kind of just roll my eyes and say, like, are you kidding me with this? It was kind of a harsh lesson that I learned in 2015, but when I kind of thought back to it, I didn't really like any of the black characters out there, at least for the most part. I like the Black Panther, but he's not one of my favorite characters. I actually respect the hell out of him. Like, the Falcon is a sidekick. War Machine is a sidekick. Black Lightning, no one really cares. A lot of these black heroes are really, really, really lame. Like, they're all kind of the same, you know, like they're all these tough-talking, strong, you know, very capable characters who always are, you know, are always at a moment's hand whenever they need to help out, you know, a white character. I didn't recognize that for a long time, but when I stopped to think, thought about it, it's like, you know, that really is the case, isn't it? You know, whether we like these characters or not, they don't really feel that, like, they service more than the needs of a certain audience. That really restricts, you know, their blackness. I mean, they might as well be white characters in blackface. I would argue that Storm is arguably the best black hero in comics because she's so powerful and so three-dimensional.
I thought the generational aspect of that was really interesting. Again, you don't want to stereotype and have one person speak for an entire race. Or in Donovan's case, to have him and his father speak for
two generations
of an entire race. But I just thought that insight was really interesting, that the father thought these were positive, empowering, in essence, as he was living through them or shortly thereafter. Again, the exact time frame, I don't know. But now as a younger, more modern man, Donovan himself looks back at those and basically says, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah. There really is a generational aspect to this period, because it's looking back and thinking, this was the best we had. That I've looked into some, you know, interviews with black creators, or like Dwayne McDuffie's commentary on Cage and some other black writers and artists who talked about Heroes for Hire, and it was like, you know, it was pretty good for the time.
Right.
Is a frequent, very common comment that when you had no other options, if this is where you were starting, it's actually a pretty good starting point.
Right. But Cage does fall into that blaxploitation element in that, as sort of Donovan was getting at in that clip. He also, it's what he wrote to us specifically, that Cage is the first unapologetic black superhero. His blackness is coded all over, and people find that fascinating.
And Donovan also continues, like, but there is still a dicey element then of, this is what a true black hero is.
Right.
Luke Cage, whether you love him or hate him, is very much a stereotype, that he is a very over-the-top, as Don said, his power is he's super black. And that sort of very narrow understanding of black masculinity with his, as Don wrote into us, buck-like strength, prison background, and get-money attitude.
Right. He said that affirmed some stereotypes that whites were bringing to those movies or to the comic books. My interpretation is that it's almost comforting to have those aspects reinforced.
Yes.
You know, Luke Cage or Shaft or whoever, they were not challenging the stereotypes, as I like to say, the way to live into those stereotypes.
And so that it's very much a double-edged sword that, and this is a thing that people talk about, I know for a fact, a lot in the gay community. There's representation, and then there's good representation. Those two things are not the same thing. There's visibility, and then there's being a nuanced, less stereotypical representation of what people are actually like. Donovan would say, like, you know, I don't see myself in Luke Cage. He actually had some comments that, for him, 90s comics, and specifically a company called Milestone,
right,
is when things turned around.
Which is why I actually, like, one of my favorite characters really is Static. That was created by Dwayne McDuffie and Dennis Cowan and Robert L. Washington III and all those guys at Milestone. When I was made aware of him, I was made aware of him from the cartoon. He was the first black character that I thought was everything I kind of wanted in a character, and everything I felt like if I was going to be a superhero, I'd be him, because he was smart. He had a really nice sense of humor. I liked his costume. the way he uses powers is very interesting. He didn't fit into any sort of box to make, you know, wide audiences feel comfortable. He existed in his own sphere.
And you read some Milestone comics back in the day. You liked Icon.
I was a fan. I had a lot of those books. May still have all of Icon. I had Static. I think that one we may have sold when we moved. Some of Hardware, Blood Syndicate. So I had a decent amount of the Milestone books, and they were generally really good.
Yeah.
That was my impression. And as Don either says or implies, they were 20 years better, in
yes.
a sense. We'd been writing black characters for 20 years. We had black creators involved in this. So there was much more subtlety and nuance and character development, all of those things that we like to see in comic books. That next sort of iteration of that type of character was definitely better.
Yes, that's the part I'm going to underline is actual black people behind the scripts and behind the pens.
Now, 20 years after that, Static has had some impact.
Mm-hmm.
He has, to some extent, sort of stuck around, but we don't see the Milestone characters all over DC. And we don't see many of those 1970s created characters. Black Lightning and Tyrock and Brother Voodoo, Black Goliath, as major parts of the...
Important players.
Yeah, as important players in comic books. But Luke Cage is still there.
Yes.
I guess what I'm sort of trying to poke away at is what is it about Luke Cage that perseveres?
I did want to take a moment here and talk, like, you know, not as though Luke Cage is the only classic black character who has survived. Jon Stewart is really prominent in all
right.
of the animated series, like has been since 2000, continues to be in Young Justice. Young Justice is actually very good.
Right.
Icon,
mm-hmm.
Rocket, and Static
mm-hmm.
are all members of either the League or Young Justice.
Blade and Deathlok have become parts of TVs or movie universes at varying degrees of visibility and success. Rhodey.
Falcon.
Falcon, of course. So there are examples of it.
But most of those mm-hmm. characters that we just listed, with the exception of the Milestone characters, John, Rhodey, Falcon, like, they're all tied really, really strongly to a pre-existing white character. And exist primarily as that black best friend, or in Jon Stewart's case, token black lantern.
I mean, to some extent, we could add Mal Duncan as a Teen Titan. The less said about Tyrock, the better, but Tyrock as a member of the Legion. You could even say Cyborg as a member of the Teen Titans. Now, certainly, DC has tried hard in the last decade or so to break Cyborg out of that role, but as I think they found out, it's actually pretty hard.
Same thing with Jon Stewart, that his
mm-hmm.
his origin and even his personality
mm.
has changed radically over the times. That if you look at his first appearance, now, Tyrock's first appearance.
Okay, that's...
is so, like, laughably uncomfortable and bad that I just love it. It has my favorite, most terrible panel in history where I'm pretty sure it's Cosmic Boy because it sounds like a really douche thing to say. Goes, oh, Tyrock, you should know we're better than that. We don't even see race. Whether you're white or red or blue or yellow, we don't care. And over those four people are Saturn Girl, Shadow Lass, Dawnstar, and Karate Kid. And let me just say, Karate Kid pre-1990 was really yellow. So, so very yellow. But they tried. Like, it's just so bad, but at least they were trying. The cover to Jon Stewart's first appearance is possibly the most overtly racist of the first appearance comics. Like, people have issue with Cage's first appearance. But at least he's, like, breaking out of chains and trying to, like, sass back the people who are, like, messing with him and being kind of awesome in a very stereotypical manner. Jon Stewart is just hunched over with his giant black afro and his teeth bared, like, holding Hal by the back of his neck. And it is the most horrifically, painfully racist cover I think I've ever seen. I was describing it to you, and you were like, so Jon Stewart in his first appearance, played by some guy Tarzan found in the jungle.
That's like, what it yes. sounded like, yeah.
There's something about how bad it was at the time mm-hmm. that any character who even slightly deviated from that was a positive,
mm-hmm.
positive influence.
We're sort of getting into the area that Derek Howard touched on when he talked about what is it about Luke Cage that has persevered. So let's drop in his audio here.
The reason that I think that Luke has had a longevity besides characters like, I should say outside of characters like Falcon and Black Lightning and even Storm, and that's because Luke has always seemed like he is his own entity, okay? Like, he is an individual hero. Falcon has always seemed like a sidekick. That's just how he's always been to me. He's always been a sidekick. And Storm has always been a part of the X-Men, all right? Even Jon Stewart has been part of the Green Lantern Corps until the TV show, then became part of the Justice League. Tyrok, who was also created around that time, he was just part of the Legion. You know, none of these other heroes, and I'm including Mal Duncan from the Teen Titans, who had a bunch of different names, but he was always a part of the Teen Titans. And that's the problem with a lot of the black characters. A lot of black characters, period, they've all seemed to be part of a team. Only one of me that might be different from around that time period was Black Lightning. But he had his own reasons for why he hasn't been in the forefront as much as Luke Cage. But Luke Cage has always seemed like an individual hero. Even when he was Heroes for Hire, you knew it was a Luke Cage book, right? Power Man and Iron Fist, he had top billing, all right? And even then, Luke and Danny always seemed like partners, right? It wasn't like a Captain America Falcon dynamic where Cap was clearly the guy who was in charge, right? Or even when Rhodey took over for Iron Man for a while, he was still in Tony's shadow. When you have Luke Cage and you have him, if he was part of a team, you knew that it was just going to be temporary unless it was Heroes for Hire, where he was the guy in charge. And that is it, you know. Luke Cage's original series was over with. Then they put him with Iron Fist, right? I think it was just a renaming of the book. I can't remember. And then when that book was done, he was on the run, but he was still making random appearances until a couple of years later. You knew who Luke Cage was because, unlike Black Lightning and Black Goliath, a lot of times when they would do promotional material, you know, merchandising and things like that, you'd see Luke Cage. You know, of course he had the afro and the headband and the yellow butterfly collar shirt. Right? He was a fashion victim. But you at least saw him. He wasn't somebody's sidekick. I mean, he was Luke Cage. He always has been Luke Cage. That's probably why he has lasted all this time, right? Even if he's in the room with people like Hulk and Thor and Hercules, he always carried himself. He's always been written to carry himself as if he's the toughest guy in the room, you know? That goes a long way to people liking him. Anyway, thanks for asking, and thanks for getting me to think.
I thought that was an interesting point, the idea that as a solo person, to some extent he has more flexibility. He can be used in different situations, as opposed to Jon Stewart. If you're going to use Jon Stewart, you sort of have to explain why are the Green Lanterns involved, why him and not Hal,
can you bring
in just Cyborg without bringing in all of the Teen Titans, as opposed to Luke Cage, who as a free agent has the ability to be plugged into the FF for a little while or into some version of the Avengers, I'm sure, at some point.
He led the Avengers for a good run when Bendis was writing him.
Yeah, for periods of time, he has that ability. So creators have the opportunity of plucking him in and using him where they see fit.
Yes.
As opposed to having to explain his presence if he were one of these other team-based characters.
Yeah, and this is true for, say, Johnny Storm. Like, Johnny Storm shows up in a Spider-Man comic. You have to explain where the rest of the FF are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Luke shows up in a comic and he can just say, like, yeah, Misty dropped me off at the corner. Done. He has a partner,
mm-hmm.
and he has associates, but he does not have team members that are as intricately tied to his personal life as though they were his family, or if they lived in the tower together, or mm-hmm. something like that. He always has had that feeling of having his own independent life.
Right. And as Derek pointed out, even when he was with Danny Rand, they were either equal partners, or Luke may have been the 51% partner in that relationship. Just from a practical perspective, it was his book.
Mm-hmm.
It was his numbering that continued. And I think there's something to the fact that it wasn't called Iron Fist and Power Man.
Even if that would have been alphabetical.
Exactly.
It implies that was a choice.
Yeah. They specifically put Power Man first. And I think, in terms of what is it about Luke Cage that he's the one that has survived the most intact, he has an iconic look. You can't get around that. You know, there have been some changes to it at various times. They've attempted different sorts of looks. He does tend to always at least go back to the color scheme, I think, to reference that particular look, even if he isn't always wearing a shirt unbuttoned down to his navel. And
the chain belt.
Exactly.
And the bell bottoms. Oh, I love his look, but I'm not saying it's a good look. I'm saying that it's a look that only Luke Cage could pull off, because that is a look that demands 100% self-confidence and absolute assurance that you make that work. I think that that is actually the thing about Luke that has meant he has survived. Though it is tied very much to his blackness of, like, he is super black. But, I don't know, as like a second layer to that characterization, he is so self-confident at all times.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also tied to his ability being bulletproof. That he's not scared of anyone. Even if he's not the strongest person in the team, he can walk up into a room and be like, I'm not intimidated by any of you. And it's that very simple, self-assured self-confidence. I think it's why the street-level, blaxploitation-ish John Stewart just never really took.
Right.
Because from John, he was always talking about how tough he was. Saying that he was going to fight the power, or always explaining to the audience. Luke Cage doesn't have to tell you he is the most stone-cold, badass, cool dude in the room. He walks into a room and you just know it.
There are many reasons why you know that. I think he benefits from having an early, iconic moment. It's what we call the Squirrel Girl scenario.
If you can beat Dr. Doom,
you're pretty darn good. Luke Cage's case, it was in Heroes for Hire 9. I mean, this is way early in his publishing life where we have the where's my money, honey moment. Yes, I'm biased.
Yes, it involves Doom.
I think Doomstadt is the capital of the Marvel Universe. But it is an iconic moment. It is looked back fondly. It is memed and joked and referenced.
And lightly ribbed.
Lightly ribbed. It's not cringeworthy in the same way that some of these other iconic moments from the 70s, like you mentioned with the Legion, you're embarrassed to see them.
Or, he's just an angry black man with a chip on his shoulder. Shut up, Hal! Sit your ass down in a chair and learn something.
It helps that he had this one-on-one confrontation with Doom early in his career. I think that helps him stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, and there is something about the cojones that it takes to go toe-to-toe with Doom. I'm just going to go beat up Dr. Doom and take his wallet. Like, who thinks that?
The guy owes me $200. I'm going to get my $200. If anyone comes off a little worse for wear in that confrontation, it is Doom, whose quote is something to the effect of,
when my cronies mentioned angry black man had landed in Latveria.
Yes, when I heard the news.
Knew it had to be you.
When I heard the news that a, whatever it is, large, angry, African, black man from America had landed, I knew it had to be you, Cage.
Because you are the one. Doom may have had to go to some sensitivity seminars afterwards.
After that, but still, but I'm not going to discount the Doom factor in Luke Cage's success.
I think that's fair. And that interaction, that beautiful, iconic interaction, I think perfectly sums up why at least I like Luke Cage. He is a character who is of a certain type that I have a very soft spot for and that I will often climb on a soapbox over, which is a stereotypical character.
Okay.
He's not necessarily a bad character. Flat or simple character is not the same thing as a bad character. I really, really hate the TV stereotype of the bleach blonde, perfectly primped, gorgeous, thin, mean, spiteful, whiny, bitchy, controlling, narcissist, blonde woman. I hate that stereotype so much. And I love Cat Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Because she takes that archetype, fully embodies it, but then adds depth underneath it and adds genuine characterization under that. Because the reason that thing is a stereotype is because sometimes those people exist. But in Cat's case, and I think when people write Luke well, the same is true for him, it's taking that archetype and making a character who makes sense. That Luke has always struck me as a character who made sense. That he is so over the top and just absolutely absurd so many times. But he was coherent. And that's a thing that has continued, that there is continuity, that he is always the biggest, baddest, coolest dude in a room all the time. And people have complained that Luke Cage has evolved in that Luke Cage embodies whatever the African-American stereotype is
at
that
moment, right?
And there's something to be said about that, maybe not being positive, but being a legitimate choice.
Right.
There is something about just making him the most stereotypically black person in the comic ever at any particular time.
Whatever the details of the black male stereotype is in 2016, 1992, 1973. He's fulfilling that version of the stereotype archetype.
But then under that,
yes,
there is a continuity
building a character.
Of character, of being, that he is thoughtful. He is aware of the people around him. He wants to be a good neighbor and a supportive, helpful member of the community. It's just that the way he does that, someone said this, that, you know, he is a stereotype of a black man in the way that Peter Parker is a stereotype of a white nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And that he is, very much so, but then the nuances of the character are underneath that.
Right. It was back in 2010 or so that Marvel did, I guess, an event or a series of miniseries called Noir, Marvel Noir. And Luke Cage was one of the eight or so characters that got a four-issue mini, Luke Cage Noir. And it works partly, as Derek pointed out, he's a solo character in his own right, so I think that helped, being able to just pluck him and putting him in another time frame. In this case, it's 1930s.
Like jazz era Harlem.
Yeah, jazz era, prohibition era Harlem. And he really worked as that character.
There was an archetype there to be filled.
Yes, and his backstory of getting out of prison, in this case going to work for the local mobster, or having being invited by the local mobster to work for him, etc., etc., that he was able to work in a totally different era, a somewhat different setting. And I think that speaks to the strength of the character. Some characters, I think a lot of these 1970s characters, are locked into the 1970s. Even if they're still around in the 2010s, they're being 1970s characters.
Yeah, or they're completely unrecognizable.
Right.
Like, nobody's going to bring back Tyrock. You know, this whole DC Rebirth thing, and they're bringing back the Legion. Tyrock is not going to be a member.
Right.
With his really over-the-top, screw-the-man, top-of-his-lungs yelling, and his tiny silver hot pants. Like, that's never going to come back. Or Jon Stewart, who kind of ditched a lot of that.
Right. His character's been rebooted a couple times. I would say Deathlok in Marvel. But it fits some of that similar criteria. It's not exactly the same character either. It's Luke Cage that we have in 2016 is pretty much the same Luke Cage from the 70s, and he's the one from the noir series in the 30s. That is something that works about him that he's not just a 70s guy.
We're going to transfer at this point to talking about the Netflix show.
Mm.
There are some clips that I want to play, which are selections from interviews with Cheo Hodari Coker, who is the showrunner for Luke Cage.
And we keep the Sweet Christmas and Sweet Sister of it all, but it has like a new kind of flavor and attitude. It's the great thing about Luke Cage is that it's an adaptable character and was always meant to be adaptable, because the thing about black culture is that black culture always shifts. It changes. It evolves constantly on an almost daily basis. But at the same time, there's a continuity to it. And that's really what we're doing with this show, is that we're maintaining a 70s vibe in, you know, the 21st century, honestly.
He also said in an interview something which is, I mean, just kind of the greatest. My whole thing is, I didn't want Luke Cage to be a hero who happened to be black.
Right.
I mean, he's black the way I'm black. I wake up black. I go to sleep black. Some people will say, oh, I'm a showrunner first and not a black showrunner. Nah, screw that. Which I just think is very in line with Luke's understanding of himself, that there are characters who are incidentally black.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to have characters who are incidentally black. It's important to have characters that are incidentally female, incidentally gay, incidentally immigrants. But it's also important to have stories that are focused on that experience and what it is like being a part of that group.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I'm very excited about this show, because it looks like Coker and Mike Coulter both have a really good sort of handle on what makes Luke Cage, Luke Cage.
I would like to say, I portray him with a certain swagger. He comes in, he has great lines, you know, there's great dialogue. Sometimes he says things and I can't believe he's saying it this way, but it's just badass. Well, I've never said that in my life. I'm only getting started. You know, I would like to have said that in my life, but I've never said it.
Now, I saw an interview with Mike Coulter playing Luke Cage, and I forget the name of the actress who's playing Misty Knight.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a photograph of them sitting next to each other for this interview, and she was wearing, I swear, a yellow V-neck shirt.
That's awesome.
It could not have been a coincidence. I thought it was hilarious. I mean, it was not a deep V. Luke's deep V in the 70s was way, I mean, this was very appropriate. But it was a V-neck gold yellow shirt.
Yeah, flared out collar. And
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
Someone in the PR department and the production staff has a great sense of humor.
I'm so glad that his tiara has survived.
What are we looking for as fans of the Marvel Netflix universe? Do we want to talk just a little bit about our expectations, what we want, what we hope to see? We are recording this, in the interest of full disclosure, a few days before the debut, though it will be released after the debut. If we were smart, we would just edit in now all of the things that actually happened, but we're not going to do that.
No. What I'm really looking for, a sense of humor. because this is a thing that the Netflix shows in general, they have been very much about the street level. And today, street level is code for not very funny.
I think there were elements of Jessica Jones where they were trying that, but they were few and it was less than one an episode.
That was very dark comedy also.
Yes,
That was very much gallows humor, which is totally valid for Jessica Jones. Daredevil had some really good, funny interactions with characters, had Foggy Nelson sort of providing a little bit more of the lighthearted comedic relief, but that's mostly melodrama, romance, like relationship, soap opera-iness. So that...
Are we ever going to get someone thrown through the plate glass window at Josie's? That's all I want to ask.
I have seen the ads. Luke throws at least two people through plate glass windows.
I hope they're in separate episodes. I would prefer one in every episode.
So,
but I'm probably not going to get that.
It looks like that bare minimum we have worked up to from Matt throwing himself through a window, Jess throwing a guy through a, you know, small glass window, to there is a point where, you know, I think it's in the barbershop or in, like, the Chinese restaurant, some guy is holding people hostage, and then they try to punch Luke in the face, and that goes
as well as you'd expect, yes.
And then he just picks them up by the seat of their pants and chucks them through the plate glass window behind him. So that's going to be great. It looks like there's going to be a decent amount of sort of... not really jokes, but just sort of situational humor.
Moments.
They just released a whole bunch of clips and sizzle reels and stuff to get people excited since we're a few days out from the show dropping. There's a scene where Luke sees some dudes in ski masks go into a convenience store and he goes, oh man, I don't have time for this. But then he goes in anyway and like holds the gun and, you know, throws the bullet back in the guy's face and gets shot a couple of times and gets some holes put in his hoodie and then sort of like beats the guy on the butt and he runs away. And then the dude in the convenience store is like,
it's you.
No, man, it's you. Old man PLO style was my joint back in the day. Sweet Christmas. You a double XL?
Way ahead of you, homie.
And he just takes his hoodie off and gives it to Luke.
Nice.
I'm like, that's...
See, that could be funny.
And that's that, but that good situation.
You just want a little bit of that, yes.
That Luke Cage sense of humor. Of just like, yeah, this is nothing.
We've always teased and had some references to upcoming, what would eventually be future shows. So will Danny make an appearance? Do we want him to? Do we know if he does? Do we want him to?
I believe it has been said there is either... I know, because, like, who knows what the time thing that they're going with. There might be a thing about, like, the Rand plane crash or something. Or Danny shows up very briefly or somebody mentions him. I'm not entirely sure what the continuity is going to be. Mike Coulter has said, don't be surprised if Jessica shows up. Don't be surprised if she doesn't. That was very much a thing that they had at that moment in time. But Luke is working on moving on with his life. So who knows, maybe he'll be involved with Claire. Maybe there'll be someone else. It's mostly just Luke negotiating his place as a hero. So I'm going to be very interested in that. To take it on to a serious note, Cheo Hodari-Coker also said, again, famously, very well soundbited, 2016 is ready for a bulletproof black man. And so there's a lot of things that are very overt references that Luke goes through most of the show in a gray hoodie, riddled with bullet holes.
Right.
There's going to be a lot dealing with police brutality.
I imagine there will be some instances where he has interactions with police officers.
Yes, and some of those are going to be good. Some of those are going to be
reasonable.
Good cops trying to keep and handle on things. Sometimes he'll be working with the cops. Sometimes the cops will be working against him. Mm-hmm. So, but that's just going to be very, very interesting to see.
Right.
I
like that.
One of his adversaries in the show is sort of the drug lord gun runner. Like sort of head of the criminal underbelly. One of the other antagonists is a local politician, the mayor, city councilwoman, somebody like that. So there's definitely going to be touching on politics and being the city sort of being left to rot in poverty. And so there's going to be some stuff about white flight. There's going to be some good, interesting political stuff going on, social stuff. I'm hoping that it doesn't get too heavy just after Jessica Jones.
Yes.
I need something lighter. I need something a little bit more digestible, something that I can maybe actually binge watch.
Yeah.
Because with all three of seasons, I get to about episode 8, and I'm like, I need to take a month.
Yeah.
And digest that. I'm really excited about the music. It sounds amazing. They're working with, like, really well-known artists.
Good.
It's going to be really good, I think.
Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to the show. Looking forward to the soundtrack mixtape that will probably drop on Spotify a few days afterwards.
Luke Cage perseveres.
He does. Since we're a few days away from the debut, it means that, you know, some publications and online reviewers have seen the first couple of episodes. Mm-hmm. We have the sort of first impression reviews coming out. Someone described Luke Cage as a neo-blaxploitation epic for our times. And I'm like,
I could dig it. We'd love to hear from you about 70s blaxploitation movies and comics, about Luke Cage, the comic book character, about Luke Cage, the TV star. Whatever you have to say, we want to hear it.
You can email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or follow our blog, comment on the episode post there, relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can also comment on our Facebook page, where we will be posting links to these episodes.
If you like what we have going here, feel free to leave an iTunes review and a rating. That helps more people find the show. I want to thank Stella and Donovan for doing the Minority Report and for allowing us to use some of that audio, as well as thank Don for sending in some additional thoughts, and also thank Derek Coward for also sharing his perspective on Luke Cage. And of course, as always, we thank you guys for listening. And remember, especially when we deal with a serious topic like this, we're not experts.
We're just family.
What I've heard, Neil Adams talked about, that kind of went away when they did Jon Stewart. They could actually have, like, you know, the proper tone to their skin, like, you know, to be brown skin. And apparently the whole gray ashen thing was like an editorial mandate because, you know, as long as you keep blackness out of the comic, you know, people will still buy it.
To me, one of the most appealing things of Black Panther is that sleek, monochromatic, really awesome costume that he has. It's a great visual.
There is actually something I want to talk about with that costume, which is that he is, it's a very interesting costume. It's great, it's iconic, it's sleek, it's super cool, it follows in the sort of Spider-Man vein. It means you can't actually see any of his skin. So there's this,
That's fair.
There's an interesting thing there about it's 1966, you can't see any of his skin. Which is probably actually a good thing. You know, if anyone remembers Gabe Jones from the Howling Commandos and how gray he tended to be, and how even in the 60s there was still a pressure of, you can have a black character, but you can't really have black skin. You can't be overtly, capital B, black.
I wonder how often T'Challa out of costume was on covers in that era. Because, again, you're more likely, in terms of if you're worried about retailers or that sort of thing, having the Black Panther on a cover, again, the name, and there's some other implications, you might be a little uncomfortable. But you might not get the customer complaints. You may head off that issue if, on the inside, it's T'Challa doing T'Challa things. And that, and the fully covered person, fully covered in black, but so, fully covered
and that's
on just, the cover. I wonder what the discussions were. I have no idea. I'm just
me neither,
curious.
But I just think that it's a very... I actually sort of want to bring it up in order to give kudos for being able to find a way around, well, for distribution reasons and business reasons, we actually really can't have a black character on the cover of our book in 1966.
But we're going to anyway.
But he's going to be he's going to be all black, even if you can't show that he's all black. And I just, I wanted to give that a little sidebar.
You mentioned Gabe Jones. I can't remember where I heard this story was. I'm pretty sure it was about Jones. That in some of the early issues, you talked about some of the coloring issues, he was actually colored white. Just on the theory that the colorist or whoever was in the office assumed that this was a white squadron and assumed that the notation that the skin should be a different color was probably a mistake.
Yeah.
Oh, they couldn't have meant that. So they got some of the early proofs back. Or again, I don't remember the details of the story, but there was something to that couldn't have been what they meant. So I'll fix it here and make them white.
Yeah. Accidental color correction.
Exactly.
Yeah.